From Hook and Bullet to Policy and Science, we're here to discuss and dissect all matters of importance to Montana's rugged landscape and the people and wildlife that call it home. This is Montana Untamed. I don't know what a trout's favorite food is, but I know what a fly angler's favorite trout food is: giant salmon flies. Each year in late May and early June, trout feast and anglers flock to waterways for the giant salmon fly hatch, when the ecologically vital bugs emerge from streams as nymphs and hatch out of the water into winged adults before reproducing and dying, leaving behind only the shucks they emerged from clinging to the brush on the shoreline. With me today is Josh Murdoch, outdoors reporter for the Missoulian newspaper. Josh, let's start with a quick description of a giant salmon fly for unfamiliar listeners.
Right. So the giant salmon fly is the largest of all the stone flies. They live for about 3 to 4 years underwater as nymphs. They crawl around between rocks and pebbles on the stream bed, and they chew up and eat little bits of leaves and other organic debris that's down there on the bottom of the stream. And they do that for a couple years. And then when it's time for them to hatch, they venture to the edge of the stream and they crawl up the stream bank out onto land, and they hatch into a winged bug that can grow up to 4 inches long. They're massive bugs, but they're totally harmless. They don't bite, they don't sting. And they fly around and land on brush along the shoreline for about a week. They mate, the females lay eggs, and then they all die. They do that all in about a week after they hatch. And a study in Colorado found that as much as 75% of the stomach contents of trout there were giant salmon flies. So it's this really foundational bug that is a huge part of what trout eat. And so it's really important to everything that eat trout as well. The bugs are so big, in fact, that osprey, which will usually just swoop down and scoop up fish, have been seen picking salmon flies right out of the air to eat the bugs.
Oh, wow. So you recently spent some time with researchers on the banks of Rock Creek studying giant salmon flies. And for those of you keeping track at home, we're referring to the Rock Creek in western Montana, outside of Missoula. So who are these researchers and what are they trying to understand?
Right. So Jackson Burrell is a PhD candidate at University of Montana, and his friend and colleague, James Frakes, just completed a master's at University of Montana. And they both research insects, specifically giant salmon flies. So salmon fly populations in some key streams across the West have been declining, and in some places, they've totally disappeared. In fact, they've vanished from Utah's Provo River, and they're declining in places like the Clark Fork right here in western Montana. So the two researchers are trying to figure out what combinations of environmental factors affect the salmon fly nymph's ability to survive in the water. One of the things they found was that salmon fly nymphs in copper contaminated water can't survive in as warm of water temperature as salmon fly nymphs in uncontaminated water. But then when it comes to lead contamination, that didn't affect their temperature tolerance.
Oh, very interesting. Okay. So they also studied, you know, combinations, you know, other factors in the stream, like oxygen level and stream flow, right?
They did. So one of the things they found was that salmon fly nymphs that live in waterways with very low stream flow, not a ton of water running down the stream, they needed really cool water to survive. But nymphs that were in fast flowing streams could tolerate much warmer water. And it was up to a 10 degrees Celsius difference, which is pretty profound. But then when it came to oxygen levels, the nymphs just adapted rather than dying in low oxygen water, which really surprised the researchers. The nymph's gills are on their undersides, kind of near their legs and like on the belly of the bug. And nymphs that they had in the lab in water that didn't have much oxygen, they just ended up growing gills that were up to twice the size of those found on nymphs pulled right from Rock Creek here east of Missoula. So they found that there are some adverse conditions, like low oxygen, that the bugs will simply adapt to.
Wow, very interesting. So let's go. what sort of these factors are researchers seeing? What are they showing up in? Where are they showing up in Montana?
Right. So one of the things the researchers looked at and found that led to these discoveries was that the Clark Fork here in western Montana has a lot of copper contamination from historic mining around its headwaters. And it also has a lot of water drawn out for agricultural uses, and that reduces stream flow. And then it winds through a lot of open fields, which allows the water to warm a lot. Anybody who's driven I-90 between Deer Lodge and Missoula sees the river just cruising through these big open fields without much foliage covering it. And so they found that they could only find salmon flies in one single isolated spot in the Clark Fork upstream of Missoula, which was right around Phosphate. In comparison, though, Rock Creek doesn't have that copper contamination. It flows a lot faster and more directly through more forested areas. So it's colder, cleaner, faster water. And there's a lot of salmon flies there.
And so is Rock Creek is, I guess, when we talk about, you know, where salmon flies are and where they used to be and where they aren't now, Rock Creek is a pretty vibrant ecosystem for salmon flies, correct?
Right. And that's what both the researchers said. They said that when they kind of take the ecological diversity of insects and all animals around Rock Creek in sum, it might not be quite as ecologically diverse now as it was maybe 60 years ago. But they said generally it's a really healthy area. There's a lot of salmon flies, a lot of fish.
Okay. And now Birrell, he studied giant salmon flies elsewhere, right? And what did he learn about salmon flies elsewhere?
Right. So he was actually the person who discovered that they're completely gone from the Provo River in Utah. He got his undergrad at Brigham Young University in Provo, and he did the first study of salmon fly populations in the Provo River since about the 1950s or 60s. And back then, there were a lot of salmon flies in the river. But a few years ago, during his research, he couldn't find any. They were completely gone.
And so in your reporting, you mentioned the Salmon Fly Project. Will you tell us what that's about?
Right. So both Birrell and Frakes said that salmon flies are relatively understood and understudied and poorly understood compared to the things that eat them, especially like trout and things that eat trout like osprey. So back in February, they started a nonprofit called the Salmon Fly Project, and they hope that that can be a vehicle to further fund research on the bugs.
Oh, cool. Okay. You know, and what are these researchers watching for in the future, you know, as the effects of climate change worsen, increasing drought, high water temperature, et cetera?
Right. So some of the things that concerned them, I mean, a 10 degree Celsius difference in temperature tolerance between low flow streams and high flow streams, that's a pretty significant difference in temperature. But when they looked at the copper contaminated water versus non-copper contaminated water, the difference in temperature tolerance was about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius. And that's something that could reasonably happen in waterways across the Western U.S. in 50 years or so because of a warming Earth. And that difference in temperature threshold could determine what places do have salmon flies or don't in 50 years. And so the two hope that they can develop such an understanding of these different combination of conditions that salmon fly need that they can determine some lethal trigger points for various waterways based on the local conditions in that waterway. Like one stream might need to have water temperature below 75 degrees Fahrenheit to keep nymphs alive. But another stream one drainage over that might have other conditions, maybe there nymphs can survive up to 79 degrees Fahrenheit water. So once they know how those environmental factors interact, they can talk with land managers and other stakeholders like conservation groups and everybody who's involved in a trout stream. They can talk to them about when a specific waterway might become inhospitable. And then they can also advocate for conservation measures that could prevent that waterway from hitting those specific points where nymphs can no longer survive. But to know what those points are, they first have to understand how these different conditions interact.
Right. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you know, we have this bug that is kind of the foundational food of trout. in these places this time of year. And the trout are a foundational food. You know, we all know how the food chain works. And so these researchers are looking for these environmental factors that act as indicators for the health of this insect population. And if they know these indicating factors, they're better able to manage the resource so as not to, you know, have a complete extinction of salmon flies in a certain watershed, correct?
That's exactly right. And with the Salmon Fly Project, they hope to fund that research, and then they hope to also be able to push for, you know, environmental protection or restoration to avoid waterways from hitting those points.
Okay. And so, you know, we've covered, you know, the salmon flies foundational part of the ecosystem, you know, trout food, you know, and so on and so on. But what's their role in the economy around these trout streams, right? I mean, you know, it's not only osprey that love trout, but it's fly anglers that love trout too.
Right. And fly anglers, for that exact reason, love salmon flies because the trout love salmon flies. Frakes said that salmon flies were, as he put it, the most economically important aquatic insects. So since trout feast on the bugs, anglers come from around the world to the American West, including all over Montana, to fly fish during the annual hatch, which is, like you said, around late May and into June. And actually, John Statz, who's the manager of the Rock Creek Mercantile here east of Missoula, he said that float trips booked during the hatch are sometimes years out in advance for bookings.
Right.
And that a lot of areas that rely on tourism dollars from anglers, they see a huge boost in cash flow during the hatch. It's this marquee event for fly anglers to travel around the West and to travel from around the world to the West. So if the salmon flies go away, so do the anglers and all the money that they bring.
So, you know, I'm curious about, you know, you were in the field reporting with these researchers. Can you kind of paint the picture for folks, what it looked like? What, you know, where were you guys and how, what was that process at? What, you know, as you were shadowing these researchers, what was their process like along the banks of Rock Creek?
Right. So I went out there with Tom Bauer, who's a Missoulian photographer, and the two of us met up with Burrell and Frakes at the Rock Creek Mercantile. And we went a little bit up the road and parked our cars, and we pushed through brush and got right along the bank of Rock Creek as the water was flowing really high in early June. And as salmon flies were hatching like crazy and flying all around us, they're landing on us, crawling down the collars of our shirts. It was quite illustrative of the healthy population there. And the main reason that we were out there that day is because the two researchers were themselves getting some photos to use for the Salmon Fly Project website. But at the same time, they wanted to show us what it was that they had been working on. And so they explained while we were standing there on the banks of the stream that when they're actually conducting surveys to determine population levels, they'll go out into the stream and they will kind of disturb a set area of the stream bed into a net and see how many nymphs they can collect. And they'll do that in different places, but disturbing the same amount, the same area of the stream bed in each place. So it's kind of a standard survey of there's X amount of salmon fly nymphs in this area. And so they can use that to kind of extrapolate what the salmon fly population is. Go ahead.
So a lot of their population studies happen, at that nymph stage in the water. Is there anything they do when they actually hatch and are, you know, on the willows along the bank?
There is, it's less exact, but they will do surveys to count the shucks, that the nymphs actually hatch out of, because those shucks are left clinging to the branches right along the edge of the river. The problem with that is that if water rises or if it gets windy or if there's rain or something disturbs it, those shucks can easily fall off. So it's a little bit trickier or less exact, they said, to do it that way.
Hey, and so, you know, we've talked a lot about in the field research, you know, in your guys' time spent out at Rock Creek, but I'm curious, what did it look like in the lab? You know, what sort of, how are they studying these bugs, you know, in the, you know, controlled environment of a laboratory.
Right. So unfortunately, we didn't get to go see their actual lab setup, but they told us a lot about it. Right now, they're in the writing phase of getting their papers published and peer reviewed and stuff. But they described that not only are salmon flies vitally important to the ecosystem, but they're also really good candidates to study because, unlike other insects that are really sensitive to a laboratory setting, and they might only live for a few hours or a few days, which makes them very difficult to study. The salmon fly nymphs, they said, are really, really resilient. They'll live in the laboratory as long as they would live in the wild. So they were able to do what they described as the longest term insect studies that they're aware of.
Wow.
They were able to study them for a whole summer. So they could simulate changing conditions over months of time rather than just hours. So they would put them in different tanks, depending on what factor they were trying to measure. And they would say for temperature, they would have the water cycle daily to simulate day and night, temperature going up and down. But overall, the temperature over the course of a whole summer in the tank would generally trend warmer and warmer and warmer. So it's simulating day and night, but each day and night are a little bit warmer than the one before. And so that's how they were able to see at what point are the salmon fly nymphs no longer able to survive. And then, of course, they would do that with, you know, water with copper, water without copper, water with or without lead, water with high and low oxygen levels, and so on.
So they're able to look at populations of salmon flies in the wild, in these natural places that have these contaminants. And then they're able to not only recreate those contaminants in the lab, but also tinker with them a little bit to find out where these thresholds are. Is that a correct understanding?
Exactly. Yep. So they can look at places like the Clark Fork and say, well, this has copper, this has relatively lower stream flow or warmer temperatures, but then they can also isolate those factors in the lab to figure out which one of these factors is actually leading to a decline in the nymphs population.
Very interesting, Josh. Well, I appreciate it. Hey, so if you're listening and you want to hook into some cutthroats with a salmon fly, you better get out there pretty fast because I'm sure the hatches are going to shift here soon. Thanks for talking, Josh. I really appreciate it. And make sure everybody go check out his reporting.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Montana Untamed is a podcast from the newsrooms of Lee Enterprises Montana newspapers. Visit any of our websites or subscribe wherever podcasts are found.